From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Well, in his new book, our next guest, Colin Dickey, discusses some of the, well, as he calls, fringe beliefs and conspiracy theories from Bigfoot to the Loch Ness Monster to possibly even the discussion of what's going on with conspiracy theories during COVID. Colin is a writer, speaker, and academic. He's made a career out of collecting unusual objects and hidden histories all over the country. Colin Dickey, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me on.
So in your new book, The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained, you express your sort of delight at all of these fringe beliefs. And I'm sure it goes both ways to conspiracy theories surrounding 9/11, which is not so wonderful, to the Bigfoot, which is a little more amusing and fun to explore, I'm sure. Tell us how you find the difference between what's kind of delightful and fun and funny and an interesting history to something that seems to pervade a certain population of ours.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that this, for me, this book grew out of the 2016 election and really feeling like we were being inundated with a lot of, you know, pretty wild and sometimes scary conspiracy theories. And I wanted to take a step back and try and understand kind of how we got to this moment and where these beliefs came from. So rather than, you know, staying too topical in the contemporary moment, I went back and I looked at, you know, as you said, that, you know, the lost continent of Atlantis and Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and UFOs and other kind of stuff, and stuff that was, as you say, kind of, you know, a little bit more kind of wonderful and wondrous and open to possibility and felt a little bit kind of more fun and magical. And I tried to kind of understand how we went from that feeling to something that in our contemporary moment has gotten more and more paranoid, has gotten darker and darker, and has kind of left us in this place where these beliefs that maybe once felt a little bit harmless and fun have in fact taken on a darker cast.
Even if we talk about harmless and fun on one side of the spectrum to now darker, what do you attribute it to that people like to have some portions of culture or history shrouded in mystery, and that makes them feel, I don't know, what?
Right. I mean, I think all of us have a pretty innate love for, you know, something out there, something that is sort of bigger than us, something that is as yet unexplained, something that still has a little bit of magic in it. And, you know, what I found is that what seems to happen in the late 19th century is you know, the spheres of, you know, broadly speaking, science and religion start to separate out from one another and kind of establish themselves as these kind of two poles. And you know, I mean, in many ways, they're kind of overlapping and complementary, but they both seem to posit a different kind of understanding of the world. But in both cases, that understanding is totalizing, right? You know, I mean, from the perspective of religion, everything can be explained by religion, sort of no matter what your faith is. And you know, likewise with science, you know, science sort of posits itself as a methodology that can really understand anything and kind of make sense of everything and demystify everything. And so I think that for a small but, you know, pretty prevalent group of people, there is a kind of reaction that sort of starts looking for that thing that falls in between the gaps of science and religion. And they start seizing on these kind of weirder, wilder, unexplainable or things that, you know, kind of resist an easy explanation. And they seek them out because, again, they kind of offer a different lens on the world that preserves a little bit of that mystery.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Colin Dickey. He has written The Unidentified, Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. Colin, is there a relationship between the size of the question and the size of the answer? In other words, if there's a big thing out there, COVID-19, we can't accept a small answer. It's got to be something big. It's got to be the Chinese are doing this or that. It can't be something as simple as just a virus that spilled over from the animal kingdom to the human kingdom. Is there a relationship between those two?
Oh, yeah, I think absolutely. I think that if you are a person who, for whatever reason, is prone to distrust scientific consensus or public health experts or whatever, you're in a position where the facts are going to be increasingly out of alignment with your belief system. And, you know, we saw this, we definitely saw this with the early weeks and months of the COVID crisis, where, you know, initially there was a lot of uncertainty, there was a lot of misinformation, there was a lot of wrong information, there was a lot of just unknowns. And so people developed various responses, rightly or wrongly, to what they thought was going on. And as the pandemic has evolved, you know, a lot of that information has been resolved. We know now that, you know, masks are a pretty effective way for, you know, stopping the spread and lowering transmission rates. But if you are somebody who is really beholden to whatever belief system you adopted right in the beginning, then those facts become harder and harder to reconcile with your belief system as long as you cling to it. And in order to make sense of it, then you have to increasingly adopt more and more elaborate conspiracy theories, because, you know, squaring that circle becomes harder and harder. And so you get these really elaborate mechanisms of, you know, this is a plot by Bill Gates to implement us all with microchips. Or I saw something that this is his plot to keep the museums of New York closed so that he can finally acquire the permanent collection of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. You know, just really, but, you know, people are just, what they're doing is they're rather than, you know, accept that their belief is wrong and that the facts contradict their belief, they are instead spinning out larger and larger explanations that would square the disparity between their belief and the facts on hand.
Well, one of the reasons we started Cool Science Radio 8 years ago was to shine a light on these remarkable women and men in science, because science was getting a bit of a bad, you know, bad name. And I'm curious, when you use the word facts, I mean, when you approach somebody and you present facts, and because of their belief system, they can't accept those, is there something that's happened in the last 50 years that makes facts matter less than they used to? Or 100 years ago, could you present facts to somebody and be able to get them to open their mind and think about other things? Or is there something new going on?
I feel like, you know, you can kind of answer that question both ways. I mean, I think there have always been people who put their belief system above the observed experiential reality around them. And I think you can find that going, you know, all the way back. At the same time, I do feel like you can point to a number of things that have happened maybe in the last 50 years, maybe starting with, you know, Watergate, or maybe even JFK's assassination. But you add to that, you know, the breaking news of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment, or, you know, the botched handling of the AIDS crisis, and you start to see a kind of growing sort of level of distrust among people towards the government. You know, and a lot of that, I think, is based in, you know, real reasons to be distrustful. I mean, you know, the COINTELPRO scandal and things like that, you know, there's legitimate reasons. But what has happened, I think, is that distrust has sort of taken on a life of its own, and sort of bad actors, bad faith actors, have encouraged people to take that distrust to a level to basically say, anything that you want to believe is fine, and you can disregard any kind of facts that are presented in front of you in order to preserve, you know, that belief system. So, you know, I mean, I think, like, you know, the anti-vaxxers is a good example of, you know, there's not necessarily anything wrong with having a healthy skepticism towards, you know, large pharmaceutical industries or, you know, government regulations in and of itself. But you know, we have very solid information that vaccines work. And so people sort of, it's almost like, you know, it's become a virus that's taken over them. You know, it's the skepticism has become the default mode, to the point where people don't know when and how to shut it off anymore.
Colin, you talked a moment ago about sort of bridging that gap between science and religion, but I'd like to go a little deeper into the psychology, or the type of person who tends to believe in these conspiracies and in fact is sort of looking for them and having an expectation of, you know, whether it is mythical monsters or the unexplained or the government. Tell us a little bit more about the type of thinking, the type of brain that exists in these people who are more likely to believe in this. Are they the same people that go towards cult-like behavior?
Right. I mean, I think that, like, you know, I was talking earlier about, you know, these people, they tend to be people who are looking for a kind of sense of wonder or mystery in the world. But I think also you can find that in mainstream science. I mean, we still don't know a lot about how the universe works. We don't know a lot of what's happening on the bottom of the seafloor. There's just a lot of stuff that that science is discovering every day. And for most of us, I think we can get that sense of awe and mystery. We can get that from a good PBS special or something about the history of the universe. And it's very factually based and it still sort of conveys that. What seems to happen, in the end of the 19th century is science, for lack of a better term, becomes institutionalized, right? It's no longer just something you can do at home with a microscope and make some cool new discovery or, you know, some new species that you can discover just by, you know, setting out with a bunch of friends into the wilds and coming back with evidence of some new thing. You know, now, that's those kind of discoveries, those new exciting and awe-inspiring discoveries, those are happening in, you know, sophisticated labs. They're happening, you know, as part of well-funded research. And so I think part of it is you have that sort of desire for some kind of magic or unexplained thing mixed with a resistance towards, authority or resistance towards sort of institutions, a desire to kind of be the guy or girl or whomever, you know, the person who's going to be the one who's going to make that fantastic discovery all by yourself, maybe with a pair of binoculars and some moxie.
Perhaps delusions of grandeur sort of figure into it as well. In there. I wanted to ask you, well, let's have a little bit of fun because I always like to go back and hear the lore behind, you know, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster. These stories are rooted in something that someone saw or thought they saw at some point, and the story becomes bigger around the campfire or wherever you are. Is that what happened with both of those?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, you know, with the case of Bigfoot, we have stories of, you know, folklorists will call them wildman stories, so stories of a kind of large, hairy, uncivilized kind of neighbor who, you know, kind of exists at the edge of town. And, you know, you can find those stories, you know, everywhere from China to, you know, medieval France to, Native American cultures throughout North America. So, you know, those stories are very common and they appear across cultures. But something happens in the 1950s that suddenly elevates those stories from a kind of folklore into reality. And partly it comes from, Western Himalayan explorers who kind of take this Tibetan folklore about the wild man of the mountains and sort of transforms it into what we know as the abominable snowman. And partly also it's a function of the media technology of the time, the sort of the rise of, like, you know, the weird and wacky newspaper reports, right? So the first kind of modern UFO sighting is this guy, Kenneth Arnold, is flying around Mount Rainier in Washington, and he sees these silver wings that he describes as sort of like flying wings. And he doesn't know what they are, but he follows them around. He comes back and he's like, well, you know, maybe they're Soviet technology. I should tell the FBI. He goes to the FBI office. The FBI office is closed. So instead he goes to the newspaper and the newspaper reporters take down his account. And it's really fascinating because he describes them as silver wings, but then he says they flew like a disc skipping across the water. And within 24 hours, his original description of them as wing-shaped has been eclipsed by this idea that they're flying saucers. So, like, his figure of speech becomes the literal definition. But it gets picked up on the AP wire, and it goes national overnight. And so it's sort of this weird way in which, in some ways, you know, these things start as just kind of, you know, a sighting or a folklore or something, but something about the way in which we process technology and media literacy can, like, sometimes elevate these things into a whole new sense of reality.
Boy, that is interesting. Now, Colin, your book is very well researched. What most surprised you as you looked into all of this?
You know, I try to have a kind of healthy skepticism, I would say. And I was willing to sort of accept, a lot of these stories, but I also wanted to make sure that I wasn't, kind of falling down a rabbit hole. So I tried to, look for explanations as best I could. And there were a couple of things where I was surprised at just how I was left without a really good explanation of what I thought happened. And probably, my favorite story, and certainly one of the grossest in the book, is the story of the Kentucky meat shower of 1876, when chunks of meat fell out of the sky in Olympia Springs, Kentucky, sort of on the border of West Virginia. And this was, for better or for worse, this was a documented phenomenon. They picked up the meat, they put some of it in jars. A few intrepid souls actually tried to taste it, which it's a bit too rich for my blood, but they gave it a shot. This was discussed in scientific journals. A number of different writers and scientists tried their best attempt to kind of make sense of what happened. They claimed it might have been nostoc or frog spawn or various things, and they put out hypotheses, and then those hypotheses didn't fit the evidence exactly, so they had to be discarded. And we're left with probably the best explanation is that it was a pack of vultures who vomited all in unison for some reason or another, which is kind of the best theory, but also kind of doesn't work very well at all. Nobody reported seeing the amount of vultures flooded. The amount of meat that was disgorged would require a lot of birds, and there was no record of any of that. So I was surprised that I got to the end of researching that with a sense that I wasn't really confident about, that I could say what the heck happened that day.
You spoke earlier about people that are not trustful of authority or institutions. I mean, you almost can start to see a recipe for how one would start a conspiracy theory and give it some gas and let it take on a life of its own. My sense is there's a lot of people that are doing that right now. Do you think there are?
Oh yeah, there definitely are. And certainly in the age of social media, you see that quite deliberately. I spent a lot of time researching the Flat Earth community, and unfortunately I couldn't find a way to get them in this book, but I definitely talked to one guy who he had started out as a JFK conspiracy theorist, and he had kind of moved from conspiracy theory to conspiracy theory before ending up at the Flat Earth. And the way he talked about it was basically like, This is the most far-fetched thing out there, and if you can make a case for that, then you can get people to believe everything or anything. It's basically like once you are discounting something as fundamental as the shape of the Earth that we're on, it's pretty much open season. And so yeah, you definitely see how people have figured out that there are ways to kind of take an inherent kind of healthy skepticism that we all have, we all should have, and then subtly push that, in just the right ways, so it morphs from being a kind of skepticism towards a full-blown embrace in some really dubious conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm. Our guest is Colin Dickey. His new book is The Unidentified: Mythical Monsters, Alien Encounters, and Our Obsession with the Unexplained. Colin, before we let you go, I'm wondering what advice you would give to that person who maybe that person in your family that everyone is always saying, why do you believe in these conspiracy theories? If you are that person who has fallen for these before, what might you say as advice? Because we know the more we are on social media, the more the algorithm is churning up these stories, and it probably makes it easier for that type of person to believe. So what advice would you give?
Right. I mean, I think one of the most important things is that when these are sort of deep-seated core beliefs, just giving people the factual truth is rarely going to work, because these beliefs are operating at a much more primal level than simply a search for objective truth. So in my experience, you have to start with not just sort of, telling people they're wrong or they're dumb or, giving them some, Snopes article that proves that they're wrong, but try to understand what is the belief system that this person is clinging to that is leading them to accept this kind of alternative picture of reality and try and understand. I mean, a lot of times it can be based on something totally unrelated, some kind of, you know, kind of fear or anxiety about the world. Maybe it's, you know, it's a personal fear of their own kind of physical health and well-being that then gets perverted into believing, I don't know, the chemtrails are polluting us with 5G radio waves or whatever, you know what I'm saying? But, you know, so you kind of have to pick through and figure out what's the actual belief that's underlying this? And can you address that belief and provide a better kind of working model of the world, which acknowledges and accepts that belief, but then kind of guides it to a healthier resolution? And that's not easy. It really depends on kind of person to person. And I've had to do very, you know, kind of, you know, it's almost like cult deprogramming. You really kind of have to work with somebody and validate their anxieties before you can start picking at the actual, you know, conspiracy theories themselves.
Well, such an interesting book that you have written. Colin Dickey is a cultural historian and tour guide of the weird. His book, again, is The Unidentified. Colin, thanks so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me on Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org. under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.